by the West and see how this interference can actually be dealt with.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the occasion of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. The event is underway in Saudi Arabia with only 60,000 pilgrims. The number is far below for one of the world's largest annual religious gatherings, which saw some 2.5 million attending the ceremony before the coronavirus pandemic in 2019. In his message, Ayatollah Khamenei said Muslim nations have mostly been subject to aggressive Western countries' greed and interference over the past 150 years. The leader said Muslims should now make up for the past and stand firm against the aggression and wickedness of Western powers. He noted that the straight path shown to Muslims by the Hajj is to rely on God and to show firm determination when moving forward and to have abundant hope for victory. Ayatollah Khamenei said the followers of Islam enjoy a large population, vast lands and countless natural resources and must use their assets and resources to build the future. The leader said resistance against the United States and other transgressing countries will help Muslims take their fate in their own hands. He urged Muslims to rush to the assistance of their fellows in Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other countries where the U.S. and its cohorts have been interfering for years. Ayatollah Khamenei, however, pointed out that the emergence of the resistance forces in these countries has been a blow to the aggressors. The leader said resistance fighters are eloquently expressing their firm decision to confront every act of interference and malice on the part of the U.S. and its cohorts. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the U.S. seeks to distort the will, demands, and actions of resistance forces in the region. He stressed that such efforts stem from America's deep ignorance about awake and alert regional nations. The leader noted that such ignorance led America to be humiliated in Afghanistan 20 years after its Raqqa's invasion of the country. He called on Muslims to keep up their struggle as God has truly promised to assist those fighting in his way. Ayatollah Khamenei concluded that the primary result of the struggle in the way of God will be to prevent America and other international aggressors from interfering in the affairs of Islamic countries.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have director at the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mahdi Torabi, who joins us. Also, Kevin Barrett joins us. He's an author and Middle East expert who joins us from Madison. I'd like to welcome you both. Sam Mahdi Torabi, let me first start with you. When you take a look at the statements made by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, basically saying all Muslims need to resist the West's aggression and wickedness. Now, how should these countries and Muslims resist the West's aggression, as Iran's leader has stated?
Well, we have to remember that he also mentioned the history, which is a history that, if you look back, what basically happened is that when the British, primarily, but also the French and others, but primarily the British, when they established a global empire, they came to the conclusion that in order to control this global empire, they need to control the place in the world where Europe, Asia, and Africa meet, which is what we call West Asia or the Middle East, or as the Pentagon calls it, CENTCOM. And so from that time on, there was an effort to control this region. Well, first what they did is they did it through old school classical colonialism and imperialism, which is they came in and they ruled it directly. But then later, when the Americans inherited the British Empire after World War II, this was not as easy to accomplish. And so what you had to do is you had to come and you had to take over the ruling elites and the governments of those countries, which, of course, Iran at that time was a prime example during the rule of the Pahlavis. And so basically what resistance means is that the peoples, the people who live in this region, which is West Asia, which is the heart of the Islamic Ummah, have to take control of their own destiny by taking control of the governments that rule them, as opposed to having countries, as we see, for example, Saudi Arabia and others, where the elites and the ruling class have absolutely nothing to do with the people. It's very interesting. Those countries that have popular systems of government, like in Iran, are those countries that immediately decide that they want to have an independent strategic existence and want to be independent strategic actors in the world and have their own and take their own destiny into their own hands. And those countries where the governments are completely vassals of the West and whose rule, the rule of those governments, is not in any way, shape, or form dependent on the support of their local people, those are the governments that do the bidding of the West, whether it's America or whether it was Britain in the past. So that's what resistance means. It means resisting the occupier, which is America still today, militarily in some places, and in those places that they are not directly occupying, it is establishing popular governments that take the destiny of the people into their own hands.
Yeah, and let me come to you now, Kevin Barrett, and obviously some of the statements that I'm going to be asking both you and Samat Yitarabi to cross-reference it to present day and see how it applies, that would be greatly appreciated. For example, how Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei describing resistance, as Samat Yitarabi also said there, is the key for the Islamic world, where he said, to make up for the past when they were subject to arrogance, powers, interference. What is your take on that?
Well, it's, of course, the arrogant powers interference is ongoing, and it has not really decreased, despite the defeat of the U.S. in its attempts to occupy Iraq and Afghanistan. And, of course, when I said Iran by mistake, that's really what was the ultimate target with the 9/11 false flag operation and these 9/11 wars that followed. As we learned from General Clark, the neocons revealed to him shortly after 9/11 that the real purpose of all this is to take out 7 countries in 5 years. And he listed the countries. Of course, Iraq and Afghanistan were high on the list, but the real target, the ultimate target, was indeed the Islamic Republic of Iran, number 7 on the list. And by the will of God, of course, this is bogged down and it didn't succeed. But these arrogant powers are no less arrogant than ever, even though they should have been humbled, if not outright humiliated, by what's been going on over the past 20 years, as they have revealed themselves to be completely outside of this system of ideals that they say that they are run by, democracy and freedom and the heritage of the Enlightenment and all of this, says support for self-determination. It's all totally hollow. It rings hollow after what we've seen over the past 20 years. And then today, as what is left of freedom in the West is rapidly being crushed with this handful of oligarchs that runs the West, taking complete control over the internet and what's left of free speech, erasing the PressTV.com website, and these hundreds of thousands of stories that would have been found in search engines if the PressTV.com had not been erased, many of them telling the truth about what's been going on with the 9/11 false flag and these wars that followed. So the arrogant powers, rather than admitting their mistakes, and a good way to do that would have been for the Biden administration to apologize to Iran, come back into the JCPOA, but no, they're just as arrogant as ever. And so an arrogant power that no longer has the power that it once had might be doubly dangerous, like a cornered rat. And I think that The people of the Islamic Ummah need to realize that even though there's been an apparent victory in terms of holding off the U.S. in Afghanistan, and Iraq is recovering its own destiny as well, but they're not going to stop. They're not going to go quietly, and it could even get worse before it gets better.
Okay, Samat Yitarabi, when we have the topic of this program be the statements that Iran's leader has made on the occasion of Hajj, tell us how the statements that he makes can translate into actual either motivation or action when it comes to the respective, let's say, Muslims in the region. You talked about the Muslim people somewhere in your statements. Isn't there a disconnect when it comes to certain nations and its population and what their leading politicians are doing? I mean, many, for example, in Saudi Arabia are opposed to the way that, or even UAE, are opposed to the way that the normalization deal, the Abraham Accords, for example, has come in place. Can you tell us how the leader's statement can actually influence the Muslims' minds in that respect?
Sure. I mean, I think, again, we have to look at, we have to take a longer historic and strategic view in order to understand this. And he himself, in the statement, you know, referenced all this. He said that, you know, people can make the choice between resisting, and they've seen the example of Iran, and they've seen the example of Lebanon and Iraq and other places where people have resisted. And they can see the example of places like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, where they haven't resisted, and not worse than that, they're doing the bidding of the U.S. in the region. And they are basically the tool with which the Americans try to control the region, because they can't rule it directly, as they used to in the past during the British era, or during the 1 year that they after the invasion of Iraq. So it's far more than just, you know, he's going to say something and people are going to get motivated. Of course, people are motivated. You know, this is something that we did in Iran 2 years ago. You know, the question always comes up, well, why did Iran have a revolution? Well, the reality is that, you know, being independent is a value. Being independent is something that people want. And you can give them as much, material goods as you might see, for example, in some of these countries in the southern Persian Gulf. But it's all a golden cage. It's basically they're trying to keep them quiet. And they did that in Iran a long time ago. And why did the people rise up in Iran? Because they didn't have independence. They couldn't decide their own destiny. It was basically that Iran should be the policeman and the gendarme of the Americans in the region. And that's it. And sell them cheap oil and buy Western products. And join the, you know, Western banking system. And you know, just that's it. You do that, you'll have a good life. This is what they say to this day. They say if you just, you know, not resist, and if you just follow us on issues like the right of the Palestinian people to live in their own country, things like the resistance against Israel, things like, you know, having actually popularly elected or governments that are based on the votes and on the will of the people in these countries that are the closest allies of the U.S., well, you know, don't talk about that, and we'll let you not die. You can eat, and we won't starve you with sanctions if you just, you know, stop doing that. Well, that's obviously not what Iran is going to do, and that's what Iran hasn't been doing for 42 years. And hey, let's compare Iran to a place like Egypt. You know, similar populations, you know, a country that has a very long history of civilization, exactly like the Egyptians. The Egyptians have been trying to appease the Americans for 50 years after Camp David, and see where the Egyptians are and look at where the Iranians are today. You know, and you know, I don't even have to mention the details. Everybody knows. You don't even have to talk about, you know, technology or, you know, the living standard or human development index or Gini or whatever other things that anybody wants to use as a measure of looking and comparing two countries that are very similar, like Iran and Egypt, and the result of resistance and the result of appeasement. So this is what it's about. It's a reminder. You know, Imam started the issue of making the Muslims and the Ummah aware of things during Hajj, and understanding that Hajj is not just some empty ritual where you go and you circle an old building and, you know, you do some prayers. It's about Islamic unity. It's about showing, you know, the reality of what it means to be a Muslim in terms of rule, in terms of, you know, Islam is not just about personal worship. It's not about, you know, how do I do personal prayer? It's about actually, you know, managing human society. It's about managing human civilization and having your own civilization. That's what Islam is. It's not really about personal worship, or you can't just reduce it to that thing, which is what, of course, the enemies of Islam want, is that we reduce Islam to this very banal, you know, thing that has no value in terms of taking our destiny into our own hands. So this is what the message of the leader is to the Ummah.
And Kevin Barrett, maybe you could break this down a little bit for us in terms of the way that the U.S. is viewing the West Asia region, because obviously they have tried their military option with many countries in the region, in which Iran's leaders stated some of those countries, such as Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and of course they'd like to get their hands on Iran. But the military option has not worked, I mean, after all these years. So and also we can talk about a little bit further down, going west to the longest military engagement that they had, and that was Afghanistan, which they are claiming that they're pulling out their forces and all that. So do you think the U.S. is reevaluating itself in the region? What is it doing? I mean, where does it stand?
Well, I think some American policymakers recognize that the military option has not worked and they're the ones who are partly responsible for keeping it from having been even worse and crazier, more destructive, and a bigger failure than it actually was. However, we should never underestimate the stupidity and evil of substantial segments of the elites that make U.S. policy, particularly the ones who are driven consciously or unconsciously by the Zionist, millenarian, messianic kind of fanaticism and paranoia that everybody in the world wants to drive the Jews into the sea and so on. Those kinds of people are willing to do outrageously irrational things and to adjust their perceptions so that they don't really see the obvious realities. But I think that the Americans are going to have to try something different at this point if they're going to shore up what remains of their empire in the region. And I certainly would expect that they would be reluctant to do any more of these out-and-out invasions with large numbers of U.S. troops that failed so abysmally in Iraq and Afghanistan. However, I wouldn't put it past them to try more surgical approaches to continue to inflict death and destruction on the region in more indirect ways and perhaps even deniable ways. We need to talk about the fact that COVID-19 appears to have been unleashed on the world by a neoconservative that is out of the U.S., a neoconservative biowar strike on Wuhan and Qom. And there's a very strong case for this, much of it a strong circumstantial case, but also a couple of real smoking guns proving that this is where it came from. I urge people to go to UNZ.com, that's UNZ.com, and read Ron Unz's magisterial work on this. And this is, of course, what the leader was saying back in March of 2020, that in fact we are under biological attack. And General Hossein Salami said, today the country is engaged in biological battle. We will prevail in this fight against the virus, which might be the product of an American biological attack, which first spread in China and then to the rest of the world. America should know that if it has done so, it will return to itself. And those words were indeed prophetic. We shouldn't put it past the people who came up with all of these bizarre futuristic war doctrines that they couldn't wait to try out in living laboratories and inflict death and destruction and bloodshed and suffering on people across the seas, to come up with new ways of doing that. So we really do have to be on our guard, even though the empire is clearly self-destructing, and it's self-destructing because it doesn't have that moral and ethical and metaphysical intellectual foundation that the Islamic world does have. The Western world left its religious moorings a century or more ago and has now lost its ethical moorings, its intellectual moorings. It's lashing out and flailing. It's a dying beast, but it could still do a lot of harm as it dies. And so the Muslims of the world are in a position where we have preserved an authentic revelation that can provide the basis of a just and decent society where people can live in peace and pursue the highest goal of the human being, which is spiritual attainment. And we need to wake up to that. And the Hajj should remind us of this as Muslims from all over the world join together, that this is a good time to reflect on what progress we've made towards restoring Islam, not only as the basis of personal worship, as Dr. Tarabi said, but also as the basis of society. And that those are the kind of reflections that the Supreme Leader's speech should spur us to.
It seems, since we're quickly running out of time, that I need to bring this up and really get an idea from you, Sam Matthew Tarabi, if I can. When it comes to one of the issues that you don't see any really headway being made, I mean, honestly, and that is the issue of Palestine. You know, Iran's leader has, and Iran as a whole, has been behind Palestinians, behind that struggle. Why is it that, let me ask you this way. Do you think that Muslims have fallen short when it comes to the issue of Palestine, especially their leaders? Why is this still continuing, the occupation, and of course the violation of Palestinians?
No, I don't completely agree with you. I think a lot of headway has been made. Again, it goes back to what the leader said in the speech, and I really urge everyone, you know, it doesn't matter what I'm saying or what everybody else is saying, read the speech. It's a short speech, and everything's in there. He talks about that, you know, we have two paths that are clear as moral lessons. This is what he said in the speech. He said one path, one lesson is the lesson of resistance, and one lesson is the lesson of appeasement and humiliation. So, yes, there are Muslims who have been fighting for Palestine with the Palestinians, and their example is clear. One of them is Iran, the Islamic Republic, and people like Haj Qasem Soleimani. And one example is, you know, these fake countries like the UAE and Bahrain, who, when you think about it, it's not the country that's actually making peace with Israel or with the Zionist entity. It's a family-run mafia that decides that it's in their favor now to do it. And, you know, nobody's going to ask the Emiratis. And by the way, how many Emiratis are there actually in the world? The majority of the people that live in the Emirates are actually not Emiratis. How many people live in Bahrain that are actually Bahrainis? That they haven't brought in order to change the population from Shia majority to Sunni majority. And the same goes for many of those other countries. So the answer to your question is, of course we've made headway. If you just look at what happened in the last war, again, he mentions it in the speech, that all the Palestinians for the first time in decades got together and resisted, whether they were the ones that are in the 48 territories, whether it's the ones that are in the West Bank and Gaza and in Quds, and even in the camps, in the refugee camps in the neighboring countries. So the fact is that this is a time where the lines are clearly drawn. And what we did in Iran is you need to take over the government of the country wherein the government is not popular. That's the strongest weapon you can have. They don't care about personal Islam. They get scared when Islam has a government. They get scared when Islam has an army. They get scared when Islam has an intelligence organization. They get scared when Islam has rockets and missiles and satellites and satellite TV stations. That's the Islam they hate,
okay.
And that's the Islam that scares them. So it's not just simply about doing this kind of I don't know what you would call it, some sort of a idealistic the slingshot Palestinian. It's actually about taking the instruments of power into our own hands. And as we mentioned, as Dr. Barrett mentioned, Islam is a software that allows us to manage civilizations.
Okay.
There was a time when we did this. There was a time when we forgot and were invaded and were occupied. And that time is over now. We are restarting Islamic civilization, and the place it started in is in Iran. And it's spreading to other places. That's what they hate, and that's what they're fighting. And that's what resistance means.
Okay, and I'm going to address the same question to you, Dr. Barrett, if you can, in closing, in a minute, if you can, please.
Yeah, well, that's a hard act to follow. It's beautifully said, Dr. Jarabi. I appreciate that. And it's exactly right. This is the rebirth of Islamic civilization out of its near ashes after the West had invaded and occupied and plundered it for centuries. And that we're at a stage now where we're seeing the progress as Islamic Iran has withstood these decades and decades of attempts by the West to try to crush the revolution. And the West may have contained the example temporarily by preventing other countries from following the path of Iran and establishing genuinely Islamic societies under an Islamic system, but they can't stop it forever. The people of the Islamic heartland are clearly ready to throw off their oppressors. In their hearts, the vast majority of people support the Palestinians, and that struggle is absolutely central, both symbolically, because it's all about religion, and it's also very important into strategically. The moment that that project ends, the settler colonial project leaves Palestine, that's when we know that we're there.
Thank you so much for that. Let me thank our guest, Director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mahdi Torabi. Thank you for your comments. And author, Middle East expert, Kevin Barrett there from Madison. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batat, my entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. But the people divided their religion among them into sects, each faction in what it has rejoicing.
Dear listeners, in the previous program, we discussed 52nd verse of the chapter. Before that verse, the story of many prophets had been presented, and specifically in this chapter, we had different stories and different facts regarding how these prophets lived and how hard they try to invite people to monotheism. But in fact, when this Arabic word hadhihi ummatukum was used in the previous verse, it means that all the communities of the prophets were viewed by the command of Allah as one, and they were ummatan wahida. They comprise only one nation. Now it is interesting that in the 51st verse, the Almighty Allah says, فَتَقَطَّعُوا أَمْرَهُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ زُبُرًا. But people have cut off their affair of unity between them. كُلُّ حِزْبٍ بِمَا لَدَيْهِمْ فَرِحُونَ. Each party rejoicing in that which is with them. This verse talks about causing division. فَتَقَطَّعُوا أَمْرَهُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ زُبُرًا. So this fact, causing division, is a great disaster. And it has a long story. So, following the invitation to unity and harmony in the former verse, mankind is now given a warning about conflict, about disintegration, about separation with this phrase, فَتَقَطَّعُوا أَمْرَهُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ زُبُرًا. But people have cut off their affair of unity between them into sects. And interestingly, the previous verse ended saying, وَأَنَا رَبُّكُمْ فَاتَّقُونَ. So fear me. And this not fearing from the Almighty Allah is one of the causes that will actually cause division. فَتَقَطَّعُوا أَمْرَهُمْ is preceded by the fact, by the very phrase, فَاتَّقُونَ. And if you do not فَاتَّقُونَ, if you do not follow this rule, your affairs will be cut off into different sects.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Anyway, it is wonderful that every one of these parties rejoices in that which is with itself and discriminates against the other. The verse continues saying, "Kullu hizbin bima ladayhim farihun." Each party rejoices in that which is with them. The Arabic word zubur used in this verse is the plural form of the word zubra, and it means a part of the hair on the back of an animal that can be gathered together and separated from the rest. This word has been applied to everything that can be separated from something else. So the sentence, "but people have cut off their affair," refers to the division of the nations into various groups, which we talked about in the previous program regarding the previous verse. The Almighty Allah said that based on divine point of view, all nations comprise only one nation, Ummatan Wahid. Anyway, some believe that the word Zubur is probably a plural form of the word Zabur, meaning book. So the verse can mean, if this was the case, that each of them followed a heavenly book and denied the heavenly books of the others, while they had also originated from the same divine source. This is also one possible meaning. However, the sentence, "each party rejoicing in that which is with them," كُلُّ حِزْبٍ مِمَا لَدَيْهِمْ فَرِحُونَ, strengthens the first interpretation because it is somehow speaking of various parties and their biases in favor of their own claims. At any rate, this verse expresses an important social fact that the ignorant bias of groups that have been chosen certain religious schools of thought results in them closing off their minds to any other expression of divine truth. And this is what is blocking them off the light of knowledge. And interestingly, this state arises from egotism and narcissism, and it is the greatest enemy to arriving at the impartial, ultimate truth and reaching to the unity of people, because contentment and complacency in one's own tradition and that sense of alienation and hostility to other than that is often expressed when we hear something from a religion other than ours and we shut it off, we close the doors to it, and we somehow dismiss it and we run away, lest the truth apparently other than what we are used to be disclosed to us. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key.
unwind all the secrets, this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why? And this when faith begins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parsetoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
For the fourth year, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, presented a gift to the Palestinian community in Yemen. The gift is Eid al-Adha's handout for a large number of Palestinian families financed by the Political Bureau of Ansarullah.
Today, and for the fourth year, we're distributing a gift presented by our leader, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, to our Palestinian brothers. The gift is handouts of Eid al-Adha. This move is meant to emphasize the Yemeni's love and respect for the Palestinian community in Yemen. This is a humble effort, and the Palestinians deserve much more than this. We hope our Palestinian brothers will accept this modest gift.
Palestinians said this gift is another proof of the generosity of the Yemeni people, even though they are going through a humanitarian situation due to an all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
Today we receive a gift from Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and this initiative is not for the first time, but has been repeated for 4 years now. It confirms that the Yemeni people stand by the Palestinian people in all their needs, even though Yemen suffers from the Saudi war and siege. Palestine was and still is in the heart of every Yemeni, and we thank these great people for their generosity and these kind feelings.
The Palestinian cause is one of the top issues of consideration for Yemen's leadership. A few weeks ago, Yemen has launched a fundraising campaign to support Palestinian resistance groups. The campaign has raised more than $2 million so far.
Once again, Yemenis have proved that they are willing to share everything they have with their Palestinian brothers, even though they are going through harsh circumstances due to the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade. They say they will also contribute to the liberation of Palestine from the Israeli occupation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The rally in Havana, with tens of thousands of Cubans taking part. They came together to voice support for the island's government and protest what they see as the U.S. meddling in their country's internal affairs. The rally was held just days after unprecedented unrest erupted in Cuba over an economic crisis aggravated by the coronavirus pandemic. Revolutionary leader Raul Castro and the Cuban president were among those attending the event.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
The Cuban president criticized the U.S. for spreading false information on social media. He also blasted Washington for defaming his government and inciting hatred and violence. He said the U.S. seeks to undermine peace and stability in Cuba. Criticism of U.S. policies vis-a-vis Cuba has not been limited to its shores. Russia has also accused the U.S. of plotting a color revolution in Cuba.
The logic is simple here. It has been tested on numerous occasions by Washington in various situations. But everything is the same, instigating color revolutions against undesirable regimes. At first, sanctions are introduced against them, and artificial problems are created or imposed from outside, which complicate the social and economic situation. On this basis, tensions are provoked, and anti-government sentiment is stirred up. When a critical mass is reached, the whole blame is laid on the national government. Labels are pinned on it, its activity is discredited, and thus the situation nears a collapse.
Iran, too, says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba and should end its unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The bans were first imposed in 1960 in response to Havana's nationalization of U.S.-owned oil refineries following the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions were later extended. Even racial justice group Black Lives Matter publicly condemned the trade blockade, saying it's at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. In June, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a UN resolution to demand an end to the US economic blockade on Cuba. Only the US and Israel voted against. That was the 29th consecutive year that the UN General Assembly called for the US to end its Cuba embargo. Washington has ignored the international plea every time. U.S. President Joe Biden has called Cuba a failed state. The Cuban leaders deny that. But even if it's true, that claim serves more as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. than castigation of the island nation.
Palestinian national and Islamic groups in the Gaza Strip held a gathering near the separation fence to slam Israel for stalling the flow of goods to the enclave. Attended by a number of Palestinian resistance leaders, the gathering voiced a resistance refusal of the Israeli attempts to provoke Palestinian outrage by widening the current blockade on the crossings connecting Gaza to the outside world.
This is a message to the Israeli regime to stop awakening anger among Palestinians by imposing further restrictions on the reconstruction process in Gaza after latest escalation. What happened during the escalation might happen again, and the resistance is ready to defend Palestinians' rights under any condition. This inhumane siege is unacceptable. Our economy is already collapsed and things here are not bearable anymore.
Palestinian resistance called mediators and international community to redouble efforts to pressurize Israel into removing especially its restriction on building materials and construction work. The Israeli strikes displaced nearly 80,000 Gazans, including children, and destroyed 17,000 homes.
This Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life in Gaza. It has brought only further poverty and unemployment. Israeli regime is punishing our civilians twice, first by destroying their homes, and second by denying reconstruction materials to them.
Palestinian resistance has warned that the new pressure by Israel will intensify the current tensions. They say are considering all options to break the siege.
It is unacceptable for Palestinians to remain silent towards this inhumane blockade that has only increased the poverty rate in Gaza. We call on the international bodies to put pressure on Israel to end this blockade. International community must stand for the humanity principles which have been violated by Israel in Gaza.
Israel imposed its suffocating siege on Gaza in 2007 after Hamas took control of the enclave in an election. Palestinians here say the delay in construction will affect the economic situation of Palestinian families, especially those who've lost their homes, by pushing up poverty rates. They also stressed that the Israeli moves to impede the construction work in Gaza might trigger fresh violence. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Accusations of a state-led anti-Palestine crackdown in British schools have been proven true following the release of a case study by Muslim advocacy group CAGE, which details not only the shocking treatment of students who expressed their humanitarian support for Palestine during Israel's recent onslaught, but also that school leaders have received diktats from the government. These shock findings highlight the extent in which the government seems to be prepared to go in order to stamp out criticism of Israel at every avenue. Even young students are being targeted by the scheme, which appears bent on hampering freedom of speech on this particular issue. Out of the 47 cases documented, censorship tactics included verbal warnings, suspensions, a student being expelled, and even police intervention and a referral to an anti-terrorism agency. While most of the students' activities involves little more than vocalizing support for Palestine, fundraising, and displaying Palestine flags. CAGE representatives expressed great concern at the toxic influence government watchdogs have in the British education system.
The schools happily endorse and welcome expressions of support for the Black Lives Matter movement. They join in campaigns against Islamophobia, against any sort of racism that exists in society and prejudices. But when it comes to issues of Palestine, it's as though they are blindsided, and they very much become extensions of the policing arm of the state. Schools and school leaders have a duty to foster an environment within their schools that is conducive to civic education and to create students which are active citizens in the future. What schools should not be doing is disciplining students for practicing basic empathy and showing solidarity with oppressed people around the globe.
For adult activists, speaking up for Palestine could see your reputation assassinated. But now, even young, aspiring humanitarians could see their futures dashed simply for speaking out. Robert Carter, London.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here? And some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate, as per national recommendations, as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely, and in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontent to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive,
be vaccinated or not. So you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As angry mobs block roads and clash with the army, the price of the dollar against the Lebanese lira was skyrocketing, hinting a gloomy outlook in the horizon. In an interview Thursday night, Hariri blamed President Aoun for impeding the cabinet formation process and for his resignation.
The group led by the president has decided not to cooperate with Saad Hariri, and all the obstacles that I have faced are because of that group. I did not want to just negotiate while knowing that I cannot form a cabinet, so I resigned because it seemed to me that President Aoun does not want to form a cabinet.
presidential office slammed Hariri for his comments, declaring that Hariri was, quote, not ready to discuss amendments of any kind, and closed the door on any talks. Experts see that Hariri is now launching an internal conflict, using resistance as a scapegoat.
It was obvious that he is preparing for his election campaign, because later in his interview yesterday night, he launched his election campaign by opening fire on the resistance in Lebanon.
Observers see that talk of electoral campaigns will be the main focus in the post-Hariri resignation era.
The Americans, they haven't reached a point to let the solution take place. They are still using the financial crisis as a blackmailing means to try to blackmail the resistance in Lebanon.
The state of despair on the streets of Beirut is a reflection of the general situation.
Everyone knew there would not be a new cabinet. The country has collapsed. If the prime minister wanted to actually form a cabinet, he would go for real negotiations. The result will be death of the people, no electricity, no water, and no fuel. Lebanon has fallen.
All the people need to protest. The rich and the poor are equal now, and all six are facing the same crisis.
They all want a piece of cheese for themselves. If they cannot rule right, they should leave. People are helpless. Hunger knows no religion or sect.
With the socioeconomic crisis quickly escalating, many believe the end result will be a probable demise of the entire political system. French sources described Hariri's move as cynical self-destruction for the political class. Others considered it the start of an electoral campaign. But one thing all sides agree on is that it puts Lebanon in the face of a chaotic period ahead. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett brings it on the table, it is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and the ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the E1, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the north and the south. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously.
During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy, already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
South Korea has been hit hard by a fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with new daily cases over 1,000 for the past week. More than 50% of the recent new cases have been the more contagious Delta variant. The government has issued a number of restrictions and guidelines, including banning gatherings of more than two people, other than family, after 6 p.m.
Please refrain from going out or holding social gatherings and abide by the disinfection guidelines wherever you are. Even if you don't have symptoms, please protect yourself and your loved ones by getting tested. We can and must overcome this crisis. The government will do its best.
Bae Hyung-won and his wife operate a small seafood restaurant in Incheon, just outside of Seoul. He diligently disinfects his restaurant, adhering to social distancing protocols and other government guidelines. He says a lot of businesses in the neighborhood are just hanging on.
The current situation is affecting us tremendously. Up to now, the first to third waves of the coronavirus weren't so bad. But as soon as the fourth wave started, from the first day, the number of customers plunged by 80 to 90%.
As many countries around the world are now opening up, South Korea is under more pressure from a restive public to respond more effectively to the outbreak. Young people have been especially critical, as they will wait months for their shots amid shortages of vaccine supplies. The South Korean government had set a goal of November to achieve herd immunity. Currently, about 12% of the population has been fully vaccinated, while health officials emphasize the importance of the next 2 months in containing the recent wave of infections. Frank Smith, Seoul.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
love.